Support comes from St. Louis Public Library Foundation, helping the library serve children and their families with programs and services needed to become lifelong readers. More information about the foundation is at slpl.org.
We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast of St. Louis on the Air, brought to you by University College at Washington University. With undergraduate and graduate programs, part-time, evening, and online. University College at Washington University, offering world-class education within reach.
Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Another sign of the season tomorrow night at the Sun Theater on Grandel Square. Songstress Storm Large is appearing with her holiday program. Large is a woman of many talents. She writes songs as a cabaret performer, has performed on the musical stage, and has sung with many of the great symphony orchestras. She's also a best-selling author. Her show at the Sun is titled Storm Large, Holiday Ordeal. I spoke with her last week and suggested that Holiday Ordeal does not sound especially festive.
I call it the holiday ordeal because the holidays usually for most people end up being such a huge ordeal with travel and with family and with plans and expectations and shopping and navigating kids coming home from school, you're still working or whatever, and it's always just kind of a big mess. Doesn't matter what you celebrate, everybody's caught up and everybody else is celebrating or trying to celebrate. And so I like to have people going through all those things, just get in the room and turn off the lights and turn up the music and the sparkle and the clingy dresses and the jokes and the music that's, there's Christmas music and there's just also music that evokes, for me, the feeling of what the season should be about, which is love, exuberance, celebration, joy, reflection on the year that you've survived and looking forward to the next year and the hopes you have for the next year.
Well, give me the titles of a couple of the songs that you'll be doing.
Well, let's see. So for Christmas songs, I've been loving Elvis Presley's Why Can't Every Day Be Like Christmas, The Pretenders' 2,000 Miles. Hmm. Every now and then I'll do a super standard like... Oh Holy Night, Silent Night, I'll Be Home for Christmas. But an example of a song that I feel evokes the feeling of the season is a song from the 80s called Forever Young, Alphaville. It's kind of a new wave song, but it's just got this anthemic, beautiful sort of chorus and just this soaring melody that lifts your heart and makes you feel all giddy like a little kid, like a hopeful, innocent kid looking at Christmas lights, and Journey, Don't Stop Believing, little song that just make you feel excited and happy.
How many days a year are you on the road with this group?
With my band?
Yeah.
I would say, God, this year a lot, 150 probably this year. In general, my own self, by myself, about 250 days a year. But with my band, it's only like 150.
I don't really understand how you're able to do that and maintain the kind of energy you have on stage. I mean, as you say, a lot of travel, and of course you're working. It's all work. You're doing things like interviews like this and what have you. How do you maintain the energy level to be able to perform 250 nights a year?
For example, right now, as I give this interview, I am sitting in a bed with a huge bottle of water next to me, and I'm going to drink a lot of that water, and I'm going to lay down after this interview and go to sleep for probably 2 hours because I have a show tonight, and I have to get up at 6 tomorrow morning to get to Toronto for a show tomorrow night in Canada, and then turn right around and go to Detroit the next day. So you look at your schedule, and you have to be very measured with how you behave, how you eat, how much water you drink, and we love to have cocktails after the show, before the show, whatever. You got to be like, all right, well, I'm going to have one after the show because I've got to go to bed. I can't be out late. There's a lot of it's kind of like being an athlete, I would imagine. You got to keep your body primed and ready with some exercise, with some stretching. But the most important thing really is rest and hydration.
You know, your work has been described, and I'm sure you've heard this a million times, as a little bit bawdy and a little bit edgy. How do you bring that to a Christmas show?
Well, you know, I've been called bawdy and edgy and all dirty and young people shouldn't come. And it's like, yeah, I guess, you know, I sometimes swear, not in a symphony situation, I'm a lot more measured. But in my own shows, I'm a lot more free with my language. And but I've never been shocking in a gratuitous sense, to be shocking for shock's sake. What's the worst possible thing I could say right now? It's like I don't operate that way, but my brain is kind of different, and the way I see things is a little bit different. And sometimes people, you know, I'll say something that is a little jarring to the sensibilities of some more conservative thinking people, and I don't do that to offend. It's just me naturally behaving the way I do on stage. At Christmas, I think I have a very crazily old-fashioned Norman Rockwell fantasy fetish about Christmas. I don't do the antiseptic, what every major star has ever done for Christmas, which is like all Christmas songs, and maybe we'll make this one. Ooh, it'll rock a little bit. Ooh, and ooh, but we don't want to do too much that's weird because it's Christmas. We want to be precious with it. You know, and that's fine, but I'm more about the feeling of the season, the feeling like a little kid, the excitement of being a little kid and believing in magic and miracles and hope and redemption. You know, like It's a Wonderful Life, like all the movies that we watch forever at Christmas time. And I didn't really have parents growing up. So I have fetishized the holiday. So that's why it kind of probably comes across as a little bit edgy and alternative. But it's certainly not crude or crass.
I find in watching you perform that when you do get a little bit edgy or a little bit bawdy, that people laugh. They don't go, oh, my God. That's what I've seen.
Well, it's all in good humor, and it's all in good fun. I'm not trying to alienate anyone or make anyone uncomfortable. You know, it's just sort of how if something strikes me as funny, you know, usually someone else will. But, you know, I would never call myself a comedian, even though there is a lot of comedy in the show. It's just funny how I see stuff sometimes, is what I've been told. But, I don't know, edgy makes me think of, like, you know, people in all black being very serious and challenging the audience with political barbs and whatever. And no, I'm just like, I'm a dork. I'm a huge dork about lots of stuff. And what? I take my job very seriously, but I do not take myself very seriously. So maybe that's part of it.
Let's take a moment here to let people know why you're worth the price of admission when you perform, because I'd like to play what I consider, and I think you probably do too, but I may be wrong, of course, but your signature song, I've Got You Under My Skin, is one that I always seem to identify with you.
Okay.
Got you under my skin. I would sacrifice anything come what might for the sake of just having.
I just love listening to that, Storm.
Thank you.
Such a great rendition of it. You're
Thank
very,
you.
Very fond of the American Songbook, aren't you?
I am. There's very few things that I'll do. I mean, I'll sing songs if they're very, very much requested or asked of me, especially if it's certain for a certain program. Like, I perform a lot with Michael Feinstein, whom I adore.
Me too.
And he's just like, he's the king of the American Songbook. And so,
well, the Gershwin Songbook in particular.
Yeah, and so if he asked me to sing anything, I'd be honored to throw my throat around it. But I don't tend to go into the songbook so much because I feel like a lot of those songs have been done already perfectly. Under My Skin came out as sort of an interpretation that my music director, James Beaton, was playing around with it. And I was like, oh, and so I started singing to it. He was playing this really interesting harmonic to it. And I go, God, that really captures, for me, the urgency of the lyrics that you don't hear in other renditions. Other renditions are just kind of like, hey, I'm thinking about you, and, you know, it's all safe. And I'm like, it's not safe. Listen to what he's saying. I would sacrifice anything, come what might, for the sake of just having you near, and despite of this warning voice that comes in the night and repeats and repeats right. in my ear. It's like someone is laying in bed completely crazy thinking about somebody. That can lead down a very dark road. And in the song, it doesn't necessarily, whatever, it's fine. It makes me stop before I begin. It's an urgent song of longing, and so I was very happy with that interpretation because I don't set out to change anything or to improve anything or to do something all different, especially if it's been done already so beautifully.
Well, once again, you do a great job with that. You know, you mentioned a word, and don't misunderstand what I'm saying now. You know, you said that some things can drive you crazy. And I happen to know, having read something about you, that your mother suffered from mental illness. And that mm-hmm. at some point, they said, well, you're going to get it too. How did that impact you and inform you as a performer?
Well, it was something that, and it still is to this day, I believe, kind of common thinking amongst the mental health world that things tend to be hereditary in that regard. But I was 9 years old when a doctor said it. He wasn't diagnosing me. He wasn't treating me. He just sort of said it. Yeah, you're going to end up like your mother, but we'll know what to do. He was saying it as sort of to comfort me, saying, don't worry, you know, we know how to treat it. So because we've got your mom, we've got her handled. And they never did. They never figured out what was wrong with my mother. And it turns out, you know, I did my own, obviously, long story short, a lot of research and everything. And my mother was just traumatized from an early rough time. But how it affected me, I already felt like a weirdo and an outcast. And so it just sort of fell into line with how I saw myself already, and alienated, and I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. I didn't feel loved. I didn't feel cared for. I didn't feel like I was good enough to be protected or loved or thought much of. And so I was like, well, I'm either going to die and no one's going to really notice, or I'm going to try to live, because there's something in me. I knew I could sing. There was a couple of times when I would sing when I was really little, and grown-ups, despite themselves, would look at me with sort of this, oh, my God, look on their face. And I was like, whoa, I saw that. You looked at me like I did something special. And then I'd quickly get yelled at, you know, oh, you're just looking for attention. That's not good. Girls don't look for attention, blah, 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 whatever. But years and years and years later, when I was finally away from my family of origin, and I was singing, and I found that I could gather people around me who were impressed and made happy and inspired and excited by my voice, which was literally the opposite of how I've ever experienced really anything in my life, that people were never really happy to see me or excited by me. I was a problem. I was a problem. I needed attention. I was lonely. I was weird. I was punk rock. I was loud. I wasn't normal. I wasn't pretty. I didn't fit in. I was difficult. So all of a sudden, there's this thing that I can do that makes people happy.
Yeah,
so I just hung on to that like the horn of a unicorn and kicked it out of it. It was like, take me there. Take me wherever this goes.
So the way people respond to you and the music itself is obviously therapeutic for you.
Yeah. People ask, well, when did you know you wanted to be a singer? I'm like, well, I became an artist out of loneliness. That's all. It was something that I can do that makes me less lonely in the world. And in turn, it turns out, thankfully, it makes other people who hear me sing feel less lonely somehow, which is a great exchange. It's the best quid pro quo I can imagine.
This has gotten slightly dark here. Let's change the mood a little bit. What were Christmases like when you were growing up?
I had a handful in Pennsylvania with my father's parents who lived in a farm. And those are the Christmases that I hang on to in my head that were real Christmases with Christmas dinner and Christmas Eve and fireplaces and notes to Santa and cookies left for Santa and magic and snow and, you know, stockings and a lot of Christmases at home. We had a couple, I think, at home in Massachusetts, but a lot of Christmases ended up having to go to the hospital to have Christmas with my mother, to open presents in a mental ward. Not very happy. And then, it wasn't abusive or, you know, I was never locked in a basement or anything like that. It wasn't like a living nightmare, but it wasn't easy and it wasn't a happy home. And so, you know, you hang on to this, at least I did, hang on to these happy candlelit memories of these magical Christmases that I got to enjoy a couple times. And that was always sort of for me the bar, set that bar for what Christmas should feel like for me and what I should make other people feel at Christmas time.
You know, our time is winding down, but I do want folks to hear, and we'll end it this way, the Stand Up For Me song. I love it. And I would like you to tell me a little bit about it. I'm not quite sure what it is. It sounds like something that should be sung in church, and probably was at some time.
No, it was not sung in church, at least not yet. Not that I know of. A lot of people love this song, too. I was writing a song originally for a love song for marriage equality, in support of marriage equality. I was thinking about love songs and the perspectives of different ways to say I love you and the different ways to express love and God is love and the absence of fear is the absence of love. And I was trying to make a point about how there is no crime in loving. Every song out there, there's 90% of all music out there is already a love song. It's our human basic need. It's our human magic. It's why we exist. It's why we fight to exist. It's why we breathe and move and are motivated and inspired. It's all about love. And so it made me think about that as a love as a human condition and how love, you know, we're always praying for love and wishing for love and asking for love and sending our love to people who are in pain. And then I quickly had this odd, strange thought. What does love want? What does love want then? If we want all of this love, does love want us? What does love want? If love could ask anything of mankind, What Would Love Ask?
Stand up for me, and we'll stand together. I'm the sky above you, and I love you, everyone. Stand up for me, for your great-grandmother, for your father, brother, and each other, and everyone. Be the light, be the answer, be the music in the dark, and stand up for me, and I'll stand beside you. I'm the light that guides you from inside you and everyone.
Ah. That's Storm Large performing Stand Up For Me. Storm will be appearing tomorrow night at 8 at the Sun Theater on Grandel Square. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with public radio podcast host and producer Amy Martin about Threshold, a program that navigates complicated environmental topics. And we'll explore Metro Theater Company's unique rock and roll take on Alice in Wonderland. Podcast episodes of St. Louis on the Air are available at stlpublicradio.org, or you can subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts, the Google Podcast app, or elsewhere. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.
And everyone.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.